Listen. You smell something?
Welcome to Popped, a podcast where you can learn about and relive some of the best that entertainment has to offer. We'll revisit some of our favorite films, music, and media that helped influence and shape our lives. Now sit back, strap in, and keep your arms and legs inside the vehicle at all times. And if you have to, take a shot of whiskey to keep from swooning when you hear their voices. Here are your hosts, Daniel and Ben.
Hello, everyone. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Ben. We're coming to you today from a fire station in Manhattan that has been retrofitted into the headquarters of the world-famous Ghostbusters. In this episode, we will follow along with Egon, Ray, Peter, and Winston as they slug it out with some pesky poltergeists and then stay on to dance the night away with some of the lovely ladies who witnessed the disturbance.
Since you're here, we figure you've already seen Ghostbusters. If you have not, you may have been living under a rock. Just so you know, we're going to be discussing details that will ultimately spoil huge portions of the movie. For the sake of not having the film ruined by spoilers, we recommend watching Ghostbusters before listening to this episode.
Ghostbusters was released in theaters on June 7th, 1984, to critical acclaim and became a cultural phenomenon.
Ghostbusters spawned the sequel Ghostbusters 2, which was released in June of 1989. In 2016, a clunky reboot featuring Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, Kristen Wiig, and Leslie Jones was released. A new sequel is currently in production at the time of this podcast called Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Roger Ebert praised the film, saying the following: Ghostbusters is a head-on collision between two comic approaches that have rarely worked together very successfully. This time, they do. It's one, a special effects blockbuster, and two, a sly dialogue movie in which everybody talks to each other like smart graduate students who are in on the joke. This movie is an exception to the general rule that big special effects can wreck a comedy. Rarely has a movie this expensive provided so many quotable lines.
Dan Aykroyd originally envisioned himself, John Belushi, and Eddie Murphy in the starring roles. However, the death of Belushi brought about some massive changes to a script that saw teams of Ghostbusters fighting spirits through time and space. Ivan Reitman, who was brought on to direct after successes with Animal House and Stripes, believed the original script would have cost too much to produce, was too scary, and affected changes that we see in the final version of the script.
After pitching the script, Reitman was given the go-ahead with a budget of $25 to $30 million. Harold Ramis signed on immediately after Reitman suggested he be added to the Ghostbusters team and that the film be based entirely on Earth.
Dan Aykroyd turned to his old cast from Saturday Night Live and recruited Bill Murray to play the role of Peter Venkman. Murray was known for not committing to projects until the last minute. In exchange for funding on Murray's pet project, The Razor's Edge, his commitment to the Ghostbusters was secured.
John Candy ultimately passed on the role of Louis Tully, and the role went to Rick Moranis, who accepted it 1 hour after getting the script. Many of the character affectations were invented by Moranis, including being a talkative insurance salesman, brilliantly ad-libbing much of his dialogue, including the lengthy speech at the company party.
William Atherton was cast as the environmental protection agent, Walter Peck, a comic foil who had to remain serious in order to juxtapose the comedic absurdity of the plot. For years after the film's release, Atherton would be harassed by people in restaurants and challenged to fights because people were unable to separate the character from the actor.
The role of Dana Barrett went to Sigourney Weaver despite an audition for the part by Julia Roberts. At first, there was resistance to Sigourney playing the part because of her previous serious roles in Alien and The Year of Living Dangerously. Undeterred, she revealed her extensive comedic background at the Yale School of Drama and began walking on all fours, suggesting that Dana be possessed by the demonic dog Zool.
Ghostbusters is always streaming somewhere. Currently, it's available on Peacock, Hulu, Sling, Fubo, for free, and on Prime, YouTube, and Google Play Movies for around $3. This may change by the time this episode airs in late June 2021. So Ben, what made you choose Ghostbusters for our show?
Well, largely simply the fact that this movie was an enormous amount of fun, especially in my teen years. One thing that stands out for me, I can remember this film is the first that I remember seeing myself that came at me with so much hilarious absurdity, something I definitely was not used to in movies that I previously seen. For me, this was something entirely new, and it absolutely set a new standard for funny movies. Plus, as Roger Ebert said, there were quotes, that quotes after quotes after quotes, and they have lasted and remained useful in conversation through the years. There's, "What did you do, Ray?" There's, "When someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes."
You say yes.
And of course, "Crossing the streams" has become an almost universally understood expression of something so very bad that mere adjectives won't suffice. And these are the things that truly stand out for me about this movie.
All right. I like it.
Now, Daniel, this was also on your list of films for us to review. So what made it pop for you?
Oh, my God. Everything about this movie is perfect. I rewatched it last night knowing that we were going to sit here today. And I'll tell you what, man, there is very little wrong with this film. It is funny on every level. It has just the right blend of comedy, action, suspense. And I don't think there are many films that make me laugh as hard and as often as this one does. Granted, I've seen this so many times now that I don't laugh probably as hard as I used to, because I expect the lines and I actually say them along with the film. Yes. But I mean, I can't think of a more perfect comedy film that has really helped define pop culture for me. And a lot of the reasons why I remember things and I have focused on pop culture so much in my life is because of films like this, very much films like this. So yeah, this was on my list, and I'm glad you picked it, because if you hadn't, it would be coming up very soon on mine.
Outstanding.
So let's move on. All right, so here we go. We're going to talk about Ghostbusters. And watching this movie again, the first thing that hits you when you start watching this film is that Dr. Venkman is a fraud.
Definitely. Oh, my goodness. The way he, when we first see him taking advantage of, trying to get together with one of his grad students.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit cringy, but
it's a lot cringe. He's like torturing this guy so he can score points with this girl by making her think she has psychic powers.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, this is one of our main guys. Okay. I recognize this actor. I know he's one of our main guys, but I don't like this guy.
Hey, this is your hero. You know, I mean, he's a borderline misogynist. I mean, he's what's the actual word for that? A womanizer.
Oh yeah.
He's an absolute womanizer, and he's a quack. The whole experiment, he's completely like tainted in order to get with this girl. And the guy who's sitting there, the poor guy that's sitting there, spits his gum out after getting shocked. He actually gets it right. And Venkman, in order to prop her up, tells him, "Gee, this isn't your lucky day," and then shocks him again.
Yeah, so awful. And also, they really drive home the point that nothing Venkman does is based or even acquainted with the principles of science.
Right. He gets lectured for that later when the school administrator or whatever comes in.
That's right. He does.
Yeah. I wish I remember the exact quote. It was like, your conclusions are based on some of the worst tripe. You're not a scientist. It's fantastic.
You seem to consider science as some sort of dodge.
Yes.
Yes.
So real quickly, there's a continuity error that happens right off the bat here. And maybe I'm wrong, but I noticed it while watching. In the very beginning there, you see as they close in on the door with all of their names on it and the department that they're in, it says Venkman Burn in Hell is painted on the door. And it's a glass window. So there's a glass window in the door. And then when the guy gets pissed, he's like, "The effect, you want to know what the effect? It's pissing me off." You know, he's like, And he says, you can keep your $5. You know, they're paying him $5, right?
Right.
So when he leaves, he slams the door behind him. There's no glass window in the door.
Wow.
I just noticed that last night.
All the times I've seen it, I've missed that every time.
Yeah. A lot of times things will be shot from different directions and they'll use one exterior, and then on an interior, they use a different one. And sometimes little things like that are missed. And that was absolutely missed.
Oh, that's fun.
Nice. Yeah. So let's see here. After the whole experiment gone wrong, they get, Ray comes in and is like, oh yeah, we got our first, you know, in total nerd speak.
Peter, at 1:40 p.m. at the main branch of the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue, 10 people witnessed a free-floating, full-torso vaporous apparition. It blew books off shelves from 20 feet away and scared the socks off some poor librarian.
Obviously, Venkman's pissed off because, you know, his little game was completely ruined by, you know, somebody basically to the equivalent of coming in talking about D&D when you're trying to score the girl, you know.
Yep. Did not love that, but once I was done, they picked up, grabbed Egon, headed down to the New York Public Library, where they encountered, and they show us for the first time an actual ghost that you can see right there.
Right. And obviously we kind of skipped this, but there was the librarian in the beginning where they had the cool effects with the index cards floating all over the place. And she's wandering through and she gets scared and she comes across, we don't see this ghost in the beginning of the film, but we get to see it here. And it's them wandering around with their PKE meter, right? Their psychokinetic energy.
Yes.
And it's cool because the little thing goes, the little, you know, obviously people listening can't see me do this, but if you've seen the film, you know that the little arms go up on his reader.
Yes.
If you've ever used an actual meter, they don't do anything like that. But it was cool for the film because it gave you a nice visual of the energy that was being created by this ghost.
Yes.
And that's off the charts. I mean, that's a EMF that literally is so off the charts that it's pinned the needles, so to speak, on his PKE meter. Well, as they're walking through there, you have the bookcase fall over. And of course, you've got Murray delivering the dry line of, this ever happened to you? You know, and Ackroyd shaking his head, no. It's little moments like that that make this film so good. And when I read that they ad-libbed almost all of it, they had a script draft, and they ad-libbed in every scene. There's some sort of ad-lib going on, which is amazing.
Considering the actors, though, that actually seems kind of in line with their previous experiences.
I agree. Yeah. That whole point where he's like, you know, remember that time I stopped you from drilling through your skull? And Egon says, that would have worked if you hadn't stopped me.
Yeah.
Ad lib, you know.
That is fabulous.
What do we have there? We have them encountering their very first ghost, which is the librarian.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to come up with a plan. The first thing they do is they ask Venkman to talk to her.
Yes. Hello, I'm Peter. Where are you from? Originally.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is the ladies man, right? So he should be able to talk to a lady ghost. That doesn't go well.
Did,
you know, she's a librarian.
Go over so well. Yep.
Yeah.
She turns and shushes him.
Yeah. And then of course he comes back. He says, okay, new plan. And Ray comes up with the doozy of get her.
Oh, yep.
Which of course it literally starts this movie. You get the scare, the initial scare. And I remember in the theater, that scared the, I mean, literally, you know, if they had Depends back then, it might've been a good thing to wear. But yeah.
And so the ghost literally scares them out of the library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They got the great classic scene of them running, which is very Keystone Cops. Yes. They get kicked from the university, and this really spawns their launching into a new venture.
For whatever reasons, Ray, call it fate, call it luck, call it karma. I believe that everything happens for a reason. I believe that we were destined to get thrown out of this dump. For what purpose? To go into business for ourselves.
That's right. Because up until this point, they are not yet the Ghostbusters.
Right. I mean, they're barely scientists at this point. I mean, maybe Egon and Ray.
A couple of scientists.
Definitely not Venkman.
Scientists and a huckster.
Back off, man. I'm a scientist.
So they do this and they mortgage their future on the back of Ray Stantz.
Yes.
Right. So he's got three mortgages on the house or something.
Yeah. And I don't remember whether they say it was it his family home or simply the home that he owned.
Yeah, it was left to him by somebody in the family. I don't remember exactly either, even though I watched this last night. I don't catch every detail all the time, but three mortgages. Yeah, I know, right? Three mortgages. I'm still working on that eidetic memory, by the way.
And even as a kid, that did not sound right to me.
Yeah, I mean, it leads into, I mean, they basically get taken when they start this business, if you think about it, because they look at that firehouse.
Oh, heavens.
And remember Egon rambling off all of the things that are wrong with the firehouse. Yes. And Ray comes sliding down the firehouse pole. He's like, can we stay here tonight? I love this place. We should stay here tonight. And you know, the real estate agents, she knows she has them by the cojones because you know, Ray's calling the shots since he
that's right
has three mortgages.
Yeah. And he just loves the fun of the fire pole, and that's the sale right there.
Yeah. And what was so brilliant about this was the transitioning of them leaving the college to getting the firehouse. And they didn't, if you notice modern films right now, they would have cut this into like 30 seconds. You wouldn't get all of this exposition. You wouldn't get all the stuff that makes it so endearing. You'd get this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, you know, like Christopher Nolan or who's that director that loves to just edit the heck out of things. Did Armageddon and Transformers, Michael Bay.
Michael Bay.
Okay. Michael Bay. Michael Bay's films give me seizures. They're so over edited. But this is an example of letting the scenes play out and giving enough backstory without cutting it up so much that it becomes just like, okay, well, now you know this.
Right.
I don't want to just know this. I want to be endeared to it. I want to enjoy what I'm seeing.
Yes. The scene showed us the charm in the moments that brought us to the events.
Absolutely. Yeah. They transition to the firehouse and then they transition to Dana getting out of the cab. And what's important about that is now you've gone from the university, you've gone to the firehouse and the mortgages and all that stuff. So they're embarking on this new venture. They know based off of Egon's readings that they can capture a ghost. So you have plausibility based off of everything that's happened so far. And now you have a new character introduced, played by Sigourney Weaver. And she gets out of the cab and walks upstairs, or not walks upstairs, takes the elevator up because she's in this building that becomes the focal point of all the psychic activity going on in New York City. She gets out of the elevator and tries to walk sneakily past an apartment, and who pops out but another iconic character of this film?
Oh, heavens, yes.
Louis Tully. Yeah. And dude, what a great character. And you said it when we were doing the intro, you talked about how Rick Moranis basically ad-libbed this character and he came up with all these affectations, and it's so fantastic.
It was wonderful. And they do a delightful job of introducing the fact that he is Dana's little puppy dog that followed her home. Absolutely just so madly in crush with her. But he is also the Charlie Brown figure.
Pathetic. He's pretty pathetic.
Poor little guy for whom nothing goes right. And yet the way he delivered it is so endearing that he's a thoroughly enjoyable character, even however many years later.
I honestly think that he's probably one of my favorite characters in this film. And The irony is that John Candy would have played this role. I absolutely adore John Candy, but I cannot think of him playing this part and putting into it the same thing we got from Rick Moranis.
No, I don't think anyone else would have done it the same way. And, and for well, I was about to say for my money, but I paid for a movie ticket. So yeah, for my money, I can't see anyone else doing this role justice.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious. I would love to see what he would have brought to the role, you know, because John Candy was a brilliant comedic actor. Knowing what we got with Rick Moranis, I'm hard pressed to think that any performance would have topped that.
Yeah. John Candy would have been awesome. But having seen Louis Tully as Rick Moranis did it, I'm attached to that, and I wouldn't want to see it any other way.
Yeah. I mean, let's take some of the things that he says when he comes out and catches her in the hallway. It's like, oh, I thought that was you. It's like, she can't sneak by. It doesn't matter how quiet she is. She cannot sneak by. And he comes out and he's like, you know, just like the high speed nerd, basically.
Yeah,
and
yes.
One of those things is, yeah, I did 20-minute workout at high speed, was able to do it in 10 minutes. It's like,
I was just exercising. I taped 20-minute workout on my machine and played it back at high speed, so it only took 10 minutes. I got a great workout.
And you have to stop for a second and digest what he's saying, because he rattles it off so quickly. Right? Yeah. And he's following her, and you can tell she's uncomfortable because he's sort of her little stalker.
Mm-hmm.
But when they get towards her room, they sort of fade in. I don't know if you notice it when you watch it, because you don't hear the TV right at the beginning, but as they get towards the door, there's no sound. All of a sudden you hear the TV kind of being faded in by the sound guy. This is sort of a mistake, because you should have been able to hear the TV the whole time, right? I think. And he's like, oh yeah, you know, your TV was so loud that somebody called the superintendent. So I went and turned my TV up so people would think there was something wrong with both our TVs. And he even says something to the effect that he crawled out on the ledge and tried to get in through a window to turn the TV down.
Oh gosh, that's
I mean,
right.
Really?
And we find out later how high up in the sky, not in the air, but the sky, that ledge actually is.
Which is terrifying.
This guy has such a thing for Dana.
Yep.
That he was going to crawl out essentially close to the top of a skyscraper.
Right. But her window was locked.
Yep.
You know, and there's a theme there too, because every time he goes back to his apartment, he's locked out of his apartment.
Yes, the poor little guy.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord. So let's see what happens then that continues the advancement of this plot.
Some kind of noise came out of the kitchen. Was it in the refrigerator?
I think there was, but no. Actually, what happens next is the commercial. She goes into her apartment.
Yes, and the commercial for the Ghostbusters.
She gets the Ghostbusters commercial. And that's before she goes in and sets her groceries down in the kitchen.
Yes.
So there wasn't a noise. What happened there? She sets the eggs on the counter. And then what happens?
That's right. The eggs, they're in their packaging, they're on the counter, and they start boiling and popping open, the package pops open, and the eggs start boiling and bursting out of their shells.
Yeah, that's right. Then there's
not
the noise.
Something you usually see when you bring your groceries home.
No, she starts kind of freaking out, because I mean, who wouldn't? But I think you'd watch it, you'd freak out, but your mind would go, okay, there's got to be a rational reason why my eggs are popping out. What the heck's going on? And that's when you get the noise that sounds like a low growl from the refrigerator.
That's right. That's when it is.
And she opens it and get the Zool, right?
Yes.
So
and you go and check all these things out, because at first, most people are not going to be thinking, okay, ghosts and monsters are in my apartment. As you said, the mind seeks a rational explanation. So that's my refrigerator. There's nothing threatening in here. Well, turns out there's a big dog.
There's nothing threatening in there except for a lot of junk food. But that's later. So anyway, that also it ties Dana in, because now she has had her first paranormal experience and she's going to need help.
And now she's involved in the plot.
And this is brilliant pacing, brilliant connection of characters, because initially she has nothing to do with Ghostbusters or even any of this world. And you immediately thrust her in a situation which our heroes, quote unquote heroes, yes, are now going to have to save. Ray Parker Jr.
Yeah.
I almost said Ray Parker Lewis there because it was Huey Lewis who wrote "I Want a New Drug," and we actually had Chris Scott wrote us on our Facebook page asking us to address this, and that's the reason I kind of talked to you a little bit before this episode about this is that Huey Lewis sued Ray Parker Jr.
Because
of this.
I remember hearing that.
Yeah. And then, of course, I guess they settled out of court because it's so similar. It's extremely similar. The bass line and the guitar riff are almost directly out of "I Want a New Drug." And that partially, you can blame that on the producers because they played this for Ray Parker Jr. and said, "Hey, we want it kind of like this. We want something like this." Unfortunately, plagiarism is the best form of flattery. Would you say that?
Yeah.
Sincerest form of flattery.
On the one hand, yes. And on the other hand, it also runs into, well, as you said, plagiarism.
Yeah.
I remember hearing about the controversy as a kid. And that, in fact, was the first time I had ever even heard of Huey Lewis, who then became one of my favorites.
Right. Well, here's a nice tie-in. Our next episode is going to be on Back to the Future. And Huey Lewis, one of the reasons he actually couldn't do this film was because he was engaged in production for Back to the Future.
The project.
Yeah. Yes. So the movie studio wanted his song, but they couldn't get it. It wasn't for sale. So what they did was they did the next best thing. "Hey, Ray Parker Jr., can you make a song that sounds like this?"
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And how did he? I actually have a quote here from Huey Lewis. He was in VH1's Behind the Music series in 2001, and he said, quote, "The offensive part was not so much that Ray Parker Jr. had ripped this song off. It was kind of symbolic of an industry that wants something. They wanted our wave, and they wanted to buy it. It's not for sale. In the end, I suppose they were right. I suppose it was for sale, because basically, they bought it," unquote. Now, by saying this in the VH1's Behind the Music series, Lewis opened himself up to a counter lawsuit because he breached some sort of confidentiality agreement. So Ray Parker Jr. sued him back. And we don't actually know the results of this because it wasn't made public.
Uh-huh.
I'm guessing he ended up paying for revealing this info, though.
Sounds possible.
Well, regardless, that's what happened. And there you go, Chris. We've kind of talked about it. I don't know if you're expecting more from this, but the fact of the matter is it's history now.
Yeah. I guess one additional effect of all the controversy, though, is something that advertisers have known and said as longer than I've been alive, is that there is no bad attention.
That's true.
Everything just drives more awareness. And so it simply brought more attention to the film.
I agree. So we're going to move on because obviously we don't want to focus too much on a negative aspect of the film, even though that was a good thing for Chris to bring up. They go back to the station and obviously Annie Potts is there. Janine.
Ghostbusters, what do you want?
Completing the office.
She
is marvelous. If I ever have a secretary at anything, I want a Janine.
She was fantastic. And I love the whole Peter Venkman just not really hitting on the cylinders with her. Hold my calls. Oh, don't stare at me. You got the bug eyes thing. Yeah. Janine, sorry about the bug eyes remark. I'll be in my office, you know. And meanwhile, Egon's underneath the desk. And there's sort of that allusion to the fact that there's some chemistry between her and Egon.
Do you have any hobbies?
I collect spores, molds, and fungus.
Yes.
Nice pickup line, buddy. Nice pickup line. And, you know, of course, because he's the he's the absolute absence of misogyny, or what do you call it, womanizing. Right. He's the complete opposite of the Venkman character. He is a complete scientist.
Absolutely.
Yes.
To the point where he's completely oblivious to the fact that there's this lady who seems kind of interested in him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he is all about the science.
They don't even explore that, I don't think, until, well, maybe they touch on it, but they don't really explore it until Ghostbusters 2, which is, you know, maybe someday we'll get to that one, but I don't think Ghostbusters 2 really had the same punch as this first film. You know, when you talk about sequels being as good or better, that wasn't, I mean, I liked it, but it definitely wasn't as good as the first film.
Right.
You get the first call because the Sedgwick Hotel has a ghost.
Yes.
And she takes the call and she's asking the questions, and then she hangs up and says, after saying they'll be discreet, she hangs up the phone and she yells,
"We got one!"
And yes, all these guys have to suit up for the first time in their Ghostbusters gear, which, brilliant.
Oh, it's absolutely delightful. The suits themselves look almost, well, there was one of the guests at the Sedgwick gave voice and said, "Are you guys supposed to be exterminators?" The jumpsuits they're wearing look like they're either exterminators or sanitation workers. And yet they've got these horrendously dangerous looking backpacks.
Well, no sense worrying about it now.
Why worry? Each of us is wearing an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on his back.
They were not discreet at all. In fact, they walk in like looking like they own the place. And I want to kind of touch on something here that makes me laugh every single time I see it. When they walk in, a girl walks past them and Bill Murray's character, Peter Venkman, gives her this creepy, like, you know, this, like, he follows her with his eyes and kind of does this little smile. And his performance was outstanding, and it was noted over and over again what that performance brought to the role. But it's little things like this, where he stayed in character so well that even at a moment like that, without saying anything, you get creep.
Yes.
You get creepy womanizer right there. Doesn't have to say a word. And yep, it's,
you just see it. So in the Sedgwick Hotel, they've got this haunting. I believe the manager says, of course, all the staff know about the disturbances on, was the 14th floor. So this has been going on for some time, and he takes them up to a ballroom that's also used as a dining room at times. It's configured for a dining room now. The manager is very concerned. We want to keep this as quiet as possible. Don't want to disturb any of the guests, please. We'll be super quiet. You won't hear a thing. And then they proceed to look for no, I've got it a little backwards. They don't go straight to the ballroom.
No, they walk around the hotel first.
They walk around the hallways for a while.
Yeah, and it's Dan Aykroyd's character, Ray Stantz, who comes across Slimer first. And Slimer's at like a little, you know, one of those little trays they...
The maid cart.
Yeah, the maid cart that they take around. Is it the maid? It's like when you order dinner in.
It was the food cart.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a food cart. And he's sitting there just eating everything that's on the cart. And the reason for this is because since John Belushi had died, Dan Aykroyd had still wanted to sort of bring something to honor him into the film. So this character of Slimer was literally created based off of him.
It's an homage to John Belushi.
It's an homage to John Belushi. Just shoving all the food down his throat. And apparently this was something that Belushi had done in either a film they were in before, or, you know, it was like a little shtick that he liked to pull. But Slimer is very much the nod to John Belushi.
Sweet.
So yeah, Stance lights up the cart by firing that unlicensed nuclear accelerator in the hotel hallway, and Slimer takes off.
Yeah. And that's the first time we get to see the blast from one of these things.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty cool too. Let's see. Then you get, the guys are walking around and Bill Murray's character Venkman, then he sees it at the end of the hall.
Yep.
Now, just as a little side note that is really important, because originally Eddie Murphy was supposed to be the Ghostbuster that got slimed.
Okay.
And they had this huge part written out for Eddie Murphy, where he was this former, I think, Air Force pilot or something, or, you know, he had this huge extensive background. Wow. And brought all these things to the role. When Eddie Murphy was unable to do it or turned it down, they cast Ernie Hudson, and Ernie Hudson was excited. He took this role because of all the things this character was, and they cut most of it.
Yeah. I was going to say Ernie Hudson, Winston Zeddemore didn't end up seeing any of those things about him.
He came in much later in the film, and it's a source of frustration for him as an actor. I mean, he absolutely loved being in the movie. Mm-hmm. And if you watch any interviews with him, you'll say, oh yeah, it was a wonderful experience. It's a great part of my life. But one of my frustrations was that they had cut so much out of the script that I really wanted to act. And it's unfortunate. I mean, we got a great film still. I mean, they bring him in,
no doubt,
he brings so much to the script and to the story. Yes. By being that rational fourth member, that it really makes the film. But what could have been, had they kept all of Eddie Murphy's parts and given them to Ernie Hudson, I think it would have still been a great film. And it's unfortunate that, you know, they did change it, but it still works. So Bill Murray gets slimed.
He slimed me.
Yes.
Venkman, he slimed me. And it's one of those iconic lines. It's something you'll see on t-shirts and it's quoted everywhere.
To this day.
Yeah. But it establishes that this ghost is a menace, you know. But it's not so much the violent menace they were expecting it to be. It's just sort of a gross
pest.
which leads to the, you know, them taking care of their first ghost. They actually get Slimer in the ballroom after destroying the ballroom. And what does Egon warn them not to do?
Yep. Whatever you do, guys, do not cross the streams.
Right. Or look into the trap, which Bill Murray does.
Yes.
I looked into the trap, or whoever. Was it Bill Murray? Maybe it was Ray. Somebody says, I looked into the trap, you know, now what? And they don't address it again. It's just funny.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to bet that Bill Murray's "the flowers are still standing" thing was ad-libbed.
I suspect that's very likely.
I don't have any evidence to say that, but for some reason that feels like an ad-lib moment more than anything.
Yep.
So there you go.
So their first successful catch as the Ghostbusters.
Absolutely. And it leads to them being, in the movie itself, a phenomena, because they end up on Larry King. They're mentioned by Casey Kasem, which you did a bit on in the beginning of when we were talking about the film at the very beginning of this podcast. But I had a hard time listening to that because every time I hear Casey Kasem, do you know who I hear?
Shaggy.
Yes. So Inks, yes. I totally hear him every time he does anything.
Yeah. So after that first bit in the hotel, now they've got fame and now they've got business rolling in.
Right. Which also brings unwanted attention.
Yes. In the form of Walter Peck.
Environmental Protection Agent. So is it me, or is it only in the 80s? Can you make the environmental protection agent the bad guy? Here's the guy trying to protect everybody around them from hazardous materials, from things like asbestos and all these sort of things that give you cancer or harm your health. And somehow they managed to turn this into the villain.
As we can easily see with with our perspective today, the 80s were a different time in the world.
That's true.
Awareness of things that were bad, genuinely bad for us, not quite so high.
He plays this part to perfection. He makes you hate him. He absolutely makes you hate him. There are no redeeming qualities to this character.
No.
And that's brilliant.
He absolutely delivered an expert antagonist.
Yeah, I think the word delivered is perfect, because the way he even delivers the lines, and we noted this with the antagonist in Better Off Dead, played by Aaron Dozier.
Yes.
There is a certain way you can deliver lines that will make people hate you.
Indeed.
And there's just this smug sort of like, I don't know how to describe it, but even the way he emotes and says the words, you're like, God, this guy, like, he gives me the willies just listening to him.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think, as you mentioned during the earlier segment, our introduction of the characters, he did this so well that people could not separate the actor from the character later on, just seeing him out in the world.
Yeah. It's not unbelievable. People get so, like, their suspension of disbelief is so strong that they literally think these people are real, or that the characters they're playing are them.
Yeah. And they hold on to that even after they walk out of the movie theater.
It's kind of scary if you think about it.
It's definitely an unfortunate thing. We need to be able to let that go and separate the characters from the actors.
It shows you how influenced people can become by the media they're watching or listening to. And we've seen that extenuated, elaborated in other forms of media, including the news, where people are hated because of the way they're presented. And it's unfortunate. And I kind of feel for the guy, because, you know, brilliant acting, absolutely brilliant acting.
Brilliant acting, did his job to perfection, and then got this horrendous backlash from it.
Yeah.
which he didn't deserve, because he did so wonderfully in the part.
Speaking of being assaulted outside of this movie, very recently, I was horrified to read about an assault that took place on one of the actors from this film, who was simply walking down the street in New York. This actor has been out of circulation for a while because he wanted to spend time with his family. And he's just walking down the street, and some guy walks up and cold cocks him. Knocks him out.
What the heck?
Just out of nowhere. And I haven't followed up to see if they figured out and they caught the guy or not. But of all people, this guy walked up and knocked out Rick Moranis.
Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding.
Who,
exactly. What kind of claim to fame is that? You knocked out a little guy, and what a horrible person you are. It's just, I couldn't believe it. And you know, when I'm hearing this stuff about Walter Peck, you know, obviously these are not the same circumstances. They didn't hit him because he was, you know, somebody unlikable character in the movie. They hit him because it's Rick Moranis, and here's my claim to fame. I knocked out Rick Moranis, whatever his reasoning was. This person did something terrible, you know, and I'm glad that Rick Moranis is okay now. Rick Moranis is awesome, and he didn't deserve that by any means.
Absolutely not.
I mean, nobody deserves to have somebody just walk up for no reason and cold cock you and knock you out. I mean, he could have done long-term damage, he could have really, really hurt him for life. And who knows? I don't know the extent of whatever damage was done, but I wanted to acknowledge that here because, you know, if you're listening to this and you think that's something that you should do, don't. It just, I doubt anybody listening to this probably thinks that that's something that they would do. But I the thought process and coming to the conclusion that you should just walk up to somebody like that and punch them in the face for no reason.
But
it's just not cool.
Yeah. Let's make it very simple and very clear. That is not okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, heckling people is one thing. I mean, still kind of on the, like, why would you do it side, but physically hurting a person. Yeah.
It's no good. I mean,
Anyway, I don't want to take too much. Sorry.
Yeah, movies are supposed to be all about fun.
They're supposed to be all about fun. And these actors, they're people too. And, you know, they've got to live in this world. It's just unfortunate. But I don't want to spend too much time talking about negative things, because obviously we're here for the fun of this film.
Yes.
It was just something I felt we should address and make note of, because it is recent news. So recent within the last year. So,
wow. Okay.
Yeah. So Walter Peck, he's the bad guy, and he quote unquote bad guy. And Bill Murray tells him to, you know, basically shove it.
Essentially take a hike. Yep.
Yeah. And he'd have to come back with the, what is it called? The,
a warrant.
Or a warrant, order. A court order. Yeah.
Yep. Which is, it's interesting to think, and I, even when I first saw the film and was a young and dumb teenager, I could see immediately once Walter Peck continued coming back and kept ratcheting up the threat, Peter Venkman could have prevented all of that.
He could have.
Simply by, pardon the salty language, by not being a dick.
Yeah.
To the EPA agent who simply wanted to evaluate potential risk.
But did he? My thought was is that Venkman was reading him and saw beyond his quote-unquote guise of benevolence. He came in sort of pretending that he just wanted to see what you guys are doing here. But as soon as he got any resistance from Venkman, you know, well, because I'm interested and I want to know what it is you guys do here. The truth came out. So I think he could have, possibly he could have prevented it, but I don't think so. I think the goals of this guy the whole time were to shut down the Ghostbusters because he thought they were frauds. He thought what they were doing was unsafe and hazardous, which actually it was. I mean, when you talk about an unlicensed nuclear accelerator, these guys have equipment and gear that actually could cause great harm to a lot of people. So in a sense, he's right. It's just that the way he went about it was, I guess I'll use the word dickish. Both of them, if they had been a little bit more compromising and nice, probably could have come to some sort of amicable solution, but neither one was willing to compromise or work with the other.
Valid point.
So, yeah. Anyway, this leads to a confrontation later on in the film, but we get Bill Murray's character. Now that he's got some fame, he goes back to Dana and lets her know about Gozer worshipers and Zool and all this stuff that's going on in her apartment when he confronts her outside of the orchestra that she's in. And she's the best in her row, you know, that yes. sort of thing. And that's amazing. Not many people can hear one person in an orchestra, but, you know. And she's got the stiff with her that Bill Murray then makes fun of. And, of course, she tries to play it down and he plays it up. And it's a brilliant exchange because this potential other suitor, he's like getting in the way. He's not going to let it happen.
No. As mentioned before, Peter Venkman is the inveterate womanizer.
Yep. Which moves us forward again, and we get I don't remember the exact sequence of events here, but I know that at some point Dana ends up getting possessed by Zool. So the two dogs that are at the statues eventually come to life, and one gets Louis Tully, which is one of the more hilarious set of sequences in a movie ever.
Poor little guy's trying to host a party.
He's hosting a party, which he invites Dana and her boyfriend to.
Yes.
Which obviously is Bill Murray's character after that little orchestra session. Mm-hmm. And you get this whole ad lib segment from Rick Moranis. And according to what you said earlier in this podcast was that, you know, during the intro is that he ad libbed this long shot take. If you watch it, there's no editing going on here. And was it Jean Kasem? Is that Casey Kasem's daughter that was in there? The blonde?
I do not know.
That he dances with. Yeah, I think she was on a sitcom that came after Cheers. She was married to the character that was once married to Rhea Perlman's character, Carla Tortelli. It was called The Tortellis.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So anyway, she's at this party. He's trying to impress her, you know, and she's obviously this hot bimbo that, you know, he somehow managed to get to come to this party where he only invited clients instead of friends.
Yeah.
Right. And then he proceeds to, every time somebody shows up, list off all of their assets, whether or not they're in receivership, you know, and it's hysterical. His character is freaking hilarious. At that point, he gets the coats from the people that came in, and my favorite line of the film. Okay.
Yes.
Who brought the dog?
Who brought the dog? He opens the door and actually does not notice the dog. Then there's this demonic-looking dog, glowing red eyes, sitting on his bed. And he doesn't notice because he's still talking about the assets of the person who just came in, and tosses their coat onto the bed.
Yep.
Which comedically lands up on the dog's head. Turns back to the party, closes the door, has not noticed the dog, then hears this demonic growl coming from his bedroom.
Right.
And then simply asks, okay, who brought the dog?
I loved it.
It is an utter delight. One thing that I remember about actually the beginning of the party scene is that once again, Dana cannot sneak past his apartment, even though we hear the thumping music coming from the party through
right.
the walls and the door. Even in that room with that music, he has this inhuman, I should say superhuman radar for Dana's footfalls.
Right.
And she gets close to the door and suddenly boom, it opens and there he is again.
Yep. Disco Inferno, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's when he invites them, or invites her, right? Is it? Oh, yeah. No, he finds out that she scheduled her date at the same time as the party. She forgot his party. And that's when he invites them.
And he's crestfallen.
Absolutely crestfallen. Yeah, and
you scheduled a date for tonight?
So this is where the demon dog chases him out of the apartment. And it gets mistaken for a bear because he's yelling, there's a bear loose in my apartment. He comes running out. And the point where he gets to the restaurant is so perfect for New York. If you've ever been to New York, people ignore you. You know, you could be screaming you could be screaming bloody murder, and people will, instead of paying any attention to you, completely walk around you because you're crazy. And with that many people in one place, if you invest any time on somebody who's crazy, you're going to get sucked into the crazy. So New Yorkers have a filter, right? They have a filter for this sort of thing. And here are all these people dining at this fancy restaurant. Yes. And up comes disheveled Rick Moranis or Louis Tully with his shirt half hanging out of his pants, his hair in a mess, and he's got his hands up on the window and he's trying to get in. And these people, they acknowledge him briefly, long enough to realize, oh, here's a nuisance. Let's continue eating. And he turns around, obviously, because the dog has chased him there. And maybe he got a milk bone or something, you know. And it's so funny. It is so funny. And then you hear him scream, ah! And everybody turns. And then they go back to eating.
Yeah.
You know, there are comedic moments like that. In some of the best films, you have those moments, just like we were in the last episode, Better Off Dead. Ricky falls on the floor after dancing, and then everybody continues to dance over him. In this film, Rick Moranis' character potentially gets eaten by a dog. Well, we learn later that he's possessed, but everybody goes back to eating.
You know, like you do. Someone gets possessed by a demon dog. I've still got dinner in front of me. I'm going to finish my dinner.
I think the lesson here is if you're in New York and a demon dog is chasing you, you're hosed.
I think
no one's coming to your rescue.
Nobody.
So, yeah. Where do we go from here? Let's see. The Ghostbusters. Oh, yeah. Dana gets possessed in her apartment. The hands come out of the chair and they suck her into the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's when the Ghostbusters get a hold of Louis Tully because he has the little conversation with the horse and carriage and goes running around, trips over somebody's baggage and or their little grocery bag. He gets picked up by the police and brought to Ghostbusters headquarters, picking up, dropping off, right?
Dropping off.
And then Egon does the PKE reading, pulls him inside. And this is where you get another funny segment where Rick Moranis just wins. He wins the scene.
Yes.
You know, sniffing things and, you know, which he likes. Was it, you want some coffee? Yes. Have some. Yes. Have some. Yes,
have some.
You know, he's hilarious there. Absolutely that, hilarious.
That yes, have some is another thing that my friends and I quote to each other all the time.
It's perfect. I mean, yes. If he's ad-libbing that, I'm just so impressed. And that's when Venkman finally shows up for the date and everything's wrecked between Louis Tully's apartment and hers because a bear had been loose in the building.
Yes.
Right. A bear in New York City was loose in the building. So this, again, but that's a subtle way to say that people rationalize what happens around them by trying to come up with a rational explanation for what happened. Even though a bear in New York City isn't necessarily rational, it's more rational than saying a demon dog
yes,
came running through this building and destroyed it, chasing down some nerd.
Like you do.
Like you do.
If you're a demon dog, you got to look for the you look for the nerd or the hot lady.
Hot lady. Speaking of which, Bill Murray's Venkman goes up to the door and she opens it and she asks,
"Are you the Keymaster?"
No. And then she shuts the door in his face. And he so he tries again. Yes, because Venkman would try again. Absolutely. How many times will he go, "Well, I'm going for broke this time," right? He said that earlier.
He will not be deterred.
He will not be deterred. And yes, I'm a friend of his and helps himself in. And this is where we really learn the true extent of what's happened to her. Her, you know, there's slime all over everything. And she is turned into this sex vixen.
Pretty remarkably so.
Yeah.
Yes.
She tries to seduce him. And to his credit, a parable would be he doesn't get with the drunk girl.
Right? Yeah.
I make it a rule never to get involved with possessed people. Actually, it's more of a guideline than a rule.
Sorry, I don't know about this. Yeah, you know.
Because I think he can tell there's something a little bit more going on than just a drunk girl.
Yes. Dana floats 4 feet above the covers, which Bill Murray acknowledges later, because he has to whack her up with, what is it, Thorazine or something?
Yes.
To put her to sleep. And that's when they find out that the Keymaster and the Gatekeeper, they're both of them are in contact with these two characters from this building.
Mm-hmm. There's another great line that comes from this movie in this scene here. Bill Murray realizes there's something else happening inside Dana, but he wants to talk to Dana. And so he discovers he's talking with a creature named Zool.
Mm-hmm. There is no Dana.
Yes. He says, "Okay, Zuli, I want to talk to Dana. Can I talk to Dana, please?" And Zool is still being all seductive. "There is no Dana." Bill Murray asks, Venkman asks one more time. And then Zool gets impatient. And that's when we hear the demonic word.
"There is no Dana, only Zool."
What a lovely singing voice you must have.
To his credit, it is impressive that he takes that in stride.
Very much so. His calm, collected nature, as opposed to the way the other guys react, is what sets his character apart so much. Mm-hmm. Even when they first encounter that ghost at the library, you know, the other two are, you know, one's got his equipment out and the other one's looking around nervously, not even just there, but in the hotel. When they first come out of the elevator, Stance comes out with his gun in his palms. He's ready to go. And then Egon pulls his out. And of course, they fire at that maid's cart.
Yeah.
Murray still hasn't even drawn the stick off of his, you know, his proton pack. Yes. So he's just super relaxed and he handles all these situations so chill, which is what adds so much comedy. He's very much unperturbed. Even Peck, Walter Peck couldn't perturb him, you know? Yeah. So anyway, this is how we establish these two characters, and it all ties in ultimately to the building. And Egon, in his research, which we find out later, I think, is it while they're in prison that he reveals this, because Peck finally did come back with that court order. And they shut the grid down.
Shut down the containment grid.
Right. Imagine, you know, all the psychokinetic energy in a giant Twinkie, right?
Tell them about the Twinkie.
What about the Twinkie?
So this building is responsible for this because a man named Ivo Shandor had built this building as sort of a gateway to another world. And they did all sorts of like rituals on the roof. They were Gozer worshipers. And this is what brought all of this stuff about. And Zeddemore, as they're driving across that bridge, coming back before all of it hits the fan, starts talking about how Revelation's end of days. And this leads up to them shutting down the grid, and then all of the ghosts and the psychic kinetic energy being unleashed at one time, which wakes Dana up, which brings Lewis Tully out of the building because it's now destroyed. Their firehouse is destroyed. Yeah. And they converge on the building. Yeah. And the Ghostbusters get out of jail fairly quickly because Bill Murray appeals to the mayor's need for votes.
But if I'm right, and we can stop this thing, Lenny, you will have saved the lives of millions of registered voters.
Yes.
But this point where they talk to the mayor is fantastic. Because what do? They introduce, they have all these important people that are supposedly in the mayor's office that can't figure out how to solve the situation. So they bring the Ghostbusters in, and the Ghostbusters and Walter Peck confront each other in front of the mayor. And this is where some of the other really cool lines are. And also that cardinal or bishop, whatever, comes in. And that's brilliant as well. You know, kisses the ring and, hey, Lenny, nice to see you. Right. Yeah. Walter Peck. He says, these men brought about this hazardous thing, da da da. It's like, you turned off the grid. We warned you. You know, these men should be arrested, and you know, whatever he says. I don't remember exactly the wording here. But the mayor says, well, is this true?
Yes, it's true. This man has no dick.
You know, which Walter Peck loses it and starts to attack him. And it's great because now you've got this. You know, he suddenly shows his cards and how unreasonable he is. And Bill Murray basically, or sorry, I always want to say Bill Murray, because to me, this is Bill Murray, right?
Right.
But it is Venkman who brings up the point that if he allows them to do this and they fail, they'll go to jail peacefully. But if not, he will have saved the lives of millions of registered voters. Not only does the mayor smile, but so does the cardinal.
Yep. And right there, that essentially closes the deal.
Yeah, seals the deal. And that's, there's, again, the skill of the Venkman character is he's the mouth. He is got the charisma.
Absolutely. He is, as you said, he's the mouth. He's the fast talker.
Yep. So they go to the building. Now we're fully flesh up on all of the sequence of events as we get to the final confrontation in this film, which ironically was supposed to have been I believe from what I read, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, according to the original draft, was supposed to show up within the first 20 minutes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness.
But Reitman was like, you know, this character will be so much more believable if you put him at the end of the film.
Yeah.
Fortunately. Yeah. Cause this is what makes that believable.
Yeah, the giant city crushing thing really did need some build up to it.
It did, and the way they did it was fantastic.
Yeah.
But I love how they go through this. I mean, it's even more blown out and destroyed than before, because obviously you remember the scene where they show Dana walking in slow motion, her hair blowing, and all the windows blow out. And all of a sudden there is a set of stairs in the apartment. And this line right here is one that I quote all the time. Anytime I see a set of stairs,
where do the stairs go?
They go up. And it's a race dance and Peter Venkman, and it's classic.
So they head up the stairs and find, well, rather a disturbing change to the building. There is a huge flashing light show, some kind of, I don't know if ziggurat is quite the right word, but some sort of ancient alien-ish looking temple looking kind of thing. And is it Dana and Lewis at that point, or are they fully dogs now?
They're fully dogs. They turn into dogs in front of them.
Ah, that's right. As the Ghostbusters get there, Dana and Lewis transform into the dogs. There's Zool, and I forget the other one's name.
Was that Gozer? No, Gozer was the woman.
Gozer is the big bad.
I don't remember the other dog's name. But there's a great line comes from this.
Okay, so she's a dog.
They open the gate, and through the gate steps
Gozer.
Gozer, this sort of sexy, sort of creepy looking woman,
right?
Who is up on the dais. Dais, yeah. And another memorable point of the movie. She says something to the Ghostbusters.
And, she lists off that whole Voldrani, you know, the leader of the Voldrani, blah, blah, blah. She does the whole intro of who she is.
Here's and, my 50-word title.
Right. And the thing is that the character, as described initially, what they wanted was something that was a cross between Grace Jones and David Bowie. And I think they nailed it.
Yeah.
It is a cross between both. And, you know, they chose, I think she's like a Croatian or Serbian actress for the part, but it's not her voice that's being projected out there. In fact, I can't remember whose voice it is off the top of my head, but it's so cool that the Gozer character is really cool. And she has the lightning powers and uses it against them. But she first asked them, because Ray goes up and says, you know, demands that she departs this dimension.
As a duly designated representative of the city, I order you to cease any and all supernatural activity and return forthwith to your place of origin or to the nearest convenient parallel dimension.
Right.
And she asks, of course, she wants to know,
question.
Yeah, are you a god?
And Ray, dear Ray, just a little bit too honest.
Right?
No.
And then, of course, Winston Zeddemore, after they get just flambéed, you know.
Yes.
Ray, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say, yes!
Another one that you can still hear people quoting to each other today.
Yeah. Which leads to them having to choose the form of the Destructor, because they basically think they vaporize Gozer when she flips over them and lands on the edge of the building. They all shoot at her. She disappears. And then
they're carefully following Egon's safety precautions.
Yes, they are. And her voice comes out of the clouds and demands that they choose the form of the Destructor. And Venkman immediately figures out, oh, no. No way. I know what you're doing here. Yeah. Everybody, clear your minds. Don't think of anything. And you can see Zeddemore there, like, you know, like, clear my mind. And, you know, all of them manage to do this. The one guy who fails his saving throw.
Dear Ray.
Once again. And this is the buildup that if they had put this monster in the 20-minute mark of the film, would have failed. Because this moment right here made this not only believable, but gave it so much. When you suspend your disbelief for something that is this ridiculous and absurd, you've won. They've won as producers of the film.
Yes.
And I think that's even acknowledged in the full Roger Ebert interview, where he's talking about the payoff at the end of that film, that it was just done, crafted so well that you're just laughing and it's perfect. And the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. I mean, what a perfect way to bring about the conclusion of this film with a big bad.
Yes.
Indeed. I mean, he's ginormous. He fits between the buildings and he's stomping and, you know, even his happy Stay Puft face gets angry when they fry him with the proton packs.
What is one of the things that he does that it, one of the very few things that ever actually gets to Peter Venkman during this movie.
He steps on a church.
Steps on a church.
Yeah.
That's when Peter Venkman raises his voice.
Yep.
Nobody steps on a church in my town.
I love the line too. And this is another word I'll use when I don't want to actually cuss in front of somebody, but I'm shocked into cussing.
Yeah.
Mother pus bucket.
Yes. Yes. It's funny. I still use that today and very often without consciously remembering where I got it, but this is where it came from.
Right. But I mean, we've been going about this all wrong. He's a sailor. We get him laid, everything, you know. I just again, more and more of these, like, what seem like ad-lib lines that are perfect for this film, you know. And obviously, we know the outcome of this. They fry the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, but they do it by turning towards the gate and doing what you had said. They break Egon's cardinal rule. And they cross the streams.
Egon is the one who realizes it and tells them, okay, guys, here's what we got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Peter gets very concerned. Excuse me, Egon, you said crossing the streams was bad.
Yep.
But it's that moment of genius. Egon and Ray explain to Peter, this will reverse everything and blah, 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 and pull the gate back shut. And so they do this terrifying thing. They cross the streams, which is supposed to explode every molecule in the universe and end life as we know it.
But since the gateway's open, there is a slight chance they might survive.
That's right.
Now, here's the interesting thing. I'm thinking that this whole end segment was rewritten for crossing the streams because when they did it in the hotel, when they were in the banquet room, crossing the streams was an ad lib.
Is that right?
It was an ad lib. So this had to have been a rewrite to acknowledge the crossing the streams and make it work. Because who knows, they probably initially were just firing into the thing and it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
You know,
that sounds like a reasonable possibility.
I think a lot of times in movies, when brilliant things happen, a lot of times they just happen on the spot. And this is one of those moments where, because you know it's an ad lib earlier on, that the rewrite here essentially defines that moment, because now they've actually done something that's strong enough that could close this gate.
Yes.
And fry the Marshmallow Man, who, one of my favorite, you know, payback moments, Walter Peck gets completely covered in marshmallow.
Marshmallow glomp.
You got to imagine, though, if it's hot enough to melt marshmallow, I was always thinking, how did that not burn the hell out of him? But of course, it's movie magic. You're not going to get burned by marshmallow, because the Ghostbusters are also covered entirely in shaving cream. I mean, let's make no joke about it. It doesn't look like marshmallow. It looks like shaving cream.
Yep.
Except for Murray, except for Venkman. Venkman did not get covered in, and I think that was like a visual joke there too.
Yes. Well, he's the one and only who got slimed by Slimer.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly it. That's they played on that.
The counterbalance.
Yeah. So they save Dana and they save Lewis. Yes. You know, obviously she's happy to see Venkman, but Lewis Tully, you know, the superintendent's going to be pissed. You know? And of course they've got,
I've forgotten that,
you know, we're going to need a sample of your brain for science, brain tissue for science. Okay. I mean, he nailed that role up till the end. And again, across the board, I would say this is one of the few movies I've ever seen where every performance was perfect. I can't think of anybody in this film who was out of place, had a bad performance, and didn't contribute to the overall, all the way down to the villain, all the way down to the very last moments of this film. Everybody contributed in a positive and a perfect way to making this film what it is. It's one of the reasons I think everybody loves it. Not only is it just a great concept, a great story, but all of the performances are spectacular.
Yeah, everybody delivered.
Everybody delivered, even Ray Parker Jr., much to the chagrin of Huey Lewis.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, what else is there to talk about with this film? I mean, we could go on forever and sit and talk about our, you know, our personal feelings about this and whatnot, but I think it'd be good to let other people in on this.
I think we should.
I think we should. I think we've kind of talked enough about this, and it's we're going to try a little, I think we should try an experiment here, because we've been talking about having what we call the sound table, where we, yeah.
Do I get an unlicensed nuclear accelerator?
You know, I don't know. I'm still debating the code made of aardvark fur for you. So it's going to be one of the two.
Ooh.
But maybe it'll be both. Maybe it'll be an aardvark fur coat with an unlicensed nuclear accelerator proton pack attached to it.
You know what? If it's that, I'll take the aardvark fur. I will accept the aardvark fur as long as I get the proton pack.
Remember, you may not have a choice. So life is full of disappointments, my friend.
This Christmas is going to be ominous, folks.
Hopefully this episode wasn't one of those disappointments and everybody's enjoyed themselves so far. We are now going to segue into the sound table section and invite some friends or fans of the podcast to discuss Ghostbusters.
It's time for the sound table, where you, the listener, get to take part in the discussion.
Welcome to the first ever sound table, where we have friends and fans discuss the topic of our current podcast episode. Today's episode and discussion will center around the 1985 release of Ghostbusters.
Let's start out with an introduction. Joining us are Richard Rigoli and Dawood Zafir. Richard, I've known you since high school, and we have some similar tastes. We both grew up in greater Los Angeles, California, and now you're living in Texas. Tell us a little bit about you.
Ended up in Texas because, well, I'm married to someone who was from Texas. And when we got married, we compromised on where we were going to live, and so we live in Texas. And things that I do. I work for Coca-Cola. The thing that pays the bills is I offer technical support so people can still enjoy their sugary fizzy drink. For on the creative side, my wife and I co-author a book series called The Scale of Elements under the author titles of Rigoli and Reeves. I'm the Rigoli, she's the Reeves. I write because she makes me. And it's pretty much because it was just up to me. It's like I do the bare minimum job and then go home and I'm done. I wouldn't even be doing this extra endeavor if my friend Dan didn't say, hey, we could use some extra help and some extra voices, so come on over. So here I am kicking and screaming. No, but it's fun. Anyway, right. Enough about me. Let's have somebody else.
Well, welcome to the experiment, Ben, because that's exactly what this is.
Yes, indeed. Dawood, now you and I met, is it 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Three, I think.
Yeah, tutoring together at the local community college, where I remember what I was tutoring, but I'm blanking on what it was. Was it astronomy?
I think we met actually through a mutual friend first before I became a tutor, and then yeah, astronomy and ultimately multimedia.
That's right. We actually met the semester, and then we all also found out. Quite by accident. I don't know that anybody was actually searching. We just came up in conversation that we all enjoy tabletop gaming. So yes. I know that you are at least as big a nerd as I am.
Awesome.
I hide my nerd well, actually, and I've done so for a long time.
Well, you did until today.
Well, trust me, it's been coming out slowly but surely over time. No, I am a big nerd. I grew up actually watching reruns of the original Star Trek series on Sundays with my mom. My mom got me into this. I blame her for everything.
You have a good mom. That's good parenting right there.
Yeah, definitely. So, and love movies. My whole family, I have a big family, and we love film. I think I started acting when I was 8. I was acting in college plays. And I was actually getting credit for my sister to get through high school. So this weird requirement, like, hey, go do this play, go be in a Phantom Toll for your sister. but right. Yeah, like you said, I studied multimedia. And I finished a degree at the local college that I'm going on to, UC Santa Cruz, for game design and interactive media.
All right. Congratulations.
Thank you. I have been in and around film for a really long time. I used to do shorts with friends in high school. I've been a stunt guy on short films, and had some stint down in LA doing stuff and up here in the Bay Area. And it's just been really amazing. And I'm now with my company that I've started, we're the first game development cooperative in California. We're the third in the nation. And we're making open world RPGs. And eventually, once we finish our first game, hopefully we'll go on to do some animation as well. But look us up, Universal Equality Productions, or UEP. And I'm happy to be here.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
That is so cool.
Thank you so much for being here today.
All right. Obviously, we brought you guys on to discuss Ghostbusters, and we're just going to throw some of these questions at you. They're pretty straightforward. There's no curveballs coming at you. So I'm going to probably go start with Rick here, and then we'll go over to Dawood. And then, Ben, you can hit the next question, and we'll go from there. How's that format sound?
Taking turns? That's pretty complicated.
Yeah, taking turns. Well, we could try to all talk at the same time, but I have a feeling that won't come out very well. So
you're probably right.
So here we go. We'll start with Rick. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of Ghostbusters?
Slime. It made a big impression on me in the very first scene where it was depicted on the cards in the library basement. Mm-hmm. And just thick and oozing and dripping. And then I don't know if it was ad-libbed, but Bill Murray is scraping it off of there to collect a sample for Egon in one of those petri dishes. And he like flicks his hand and it goes right across his face. And he was just like that. If that was scripted, it was brilliant. Because it just looked like he was completely disgusted.
It really did, yeah.
Yes, it did.
From what I understand, a good portion of this film was ad-libbed. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was ad-libbed. Egon, your mucus leads up to some great, great moments in the film. Dawood, same question to you.
Yeah. this is odd. I think I was 4 when this movie came out, right? And I think the first time I watched it, I was maybe 6. And Jaws gave me a fear of the water. This movie gave me a fear of heights. I honestly, like, that last scene on top of the building, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, I tell you that being on top of a building, I always thought to myself, I hope there's no like supernatural entities up here, because I'm probably going to get knocked off this building and die. The weirdest thing, but it's so true.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh my. Yeah. The absolute pucker, the idea of falling from a great height right there.
Right.
and they're on a soundstage, that they're not literally up on top of a building, but when you're watching it, it is so believable.
Yes.
And if you have a fear of heights at all, that is rather a daunting scene.
And those dogs, man, those crazy demon dogs. I love those things to this day, but scared the crap out of me when I was a kid.
Speaking of which, we know that one of those dogs is Zool. Does it? Do anybody here, do you know the name of the other dog?
Vince Clortho.
Is it Vince Clortho?
Yeah.
Okay, so oh, it is Vince Clortho.
Key master of Gozer.
Right on.
Vince Clortho.
We were sitting there thinking about that during the podcast, and that absolutely makes complete sense. So it's Vince Clortho. Excellent.
Yes.
Keymaster. All right. Ben, it's your turn to throw one of those questions out there.
How many times do you think you've seen Ghostbusters?
Wow. Not as many as the Princess Bride, but a lot. If I had to guess, I'd say it's roughly in the neighborhood of 10 to 10 and a half times. Full disclosure, I totally started watching Ghostbusters over in December, over my winter break.
Oh, really?
And I was watching it with my kids. And then I left the room, I think probably to go cook dinner. And the movie was just playing in my head by the time I came back and it was over. Mm. And I was like, I missed something. No, they turned it off. They said, oh, Dad, we decided to watch something else. And I was like, how could you?
Betrayal. Oh, my kids would never have done that. No.
All right. And Richard, same question. Give us the number of your geek cred. How many times have you seen Ghostbusters?
I can't honestly answer that question. I'm 52 years old. That movie came out just before my high school years, just before as it was hitting. I have watched that movie in awestruck, like at the theater, and multiple times on video. I owned a VHS cassette tape that was actually worn out, where I had to get another one.
Does it still say please be kind, rewind?
I got one of those rewinder machines. Remember those things?
I do. Oh, yeah.
Just so I didn't wear out my actual VCR. There's an acronym you don't hear too often anymore. No, honestly, I have watched that movie more times than I can honestly admit to. A lot. It's like, and there's a lot of movies that I've watched a lot. If I count all the times I watched it under the influence of some kind of adult beverage or other mind-altering substance over the years, it's like there's no way to keep track. But yeah, and my daughters are probably going to rack up more watches than me at some point because they love the movie too.
Awesome.
They have to. No.
Well, anyway, that'll lead me into the next question, which is directed at you, Rick. If you could pick a favorite line from Ghostbusters, which one is it and why?
What did you do, Ray?
What did you do?
And here's why it's my famous, the favorite line. It's not just because it was a really great moment, because just the expressions on everybody's faces. Dan Aykroyd was just standing there, and everybody was like, I didn't say anything. I didn't think of nothing. Wait a minute. And it's like, and he's just, what did you do, Ray? And it's when they hear the thumping, and it's like, I couldn't help it. But Dan and I have a friend named Randy, and Randy does a lot of things. How can I say? Just, he does a lot of things. It was like, that was not a good move. That was not a well thought out move on either a game scale in a short term or a long term move. Not good. And it's like, what did you do, Ray? Is something we'd throw at him a lot. And he's like, what? Every time, what? And he knew what. But so we lived that moment as a group of friends quite a few times.
So
it's like I kind of identify with that line in that movie, because as a group of friends, we've all experienced the "what did you do, Ray" moment with our friend.
Oh yeah,
Randy. So there you go.
All right. Well, the same question to you, Dawood. If you could pick a favorite line from the film, which one is it, and why?
Oh my God, I know exactly which one, and I tell you, I don't remember the original line because I've messed with it so much over the years. But in high school, me and my friends started doing this thing where somebody would say, something or call somebody's name, Like I'd call my friend Marvin's name, and somebody would say, "There is no Marvin, only Zool." And, yes. And I have done this so much that I don't know what the original "there is" is. But Dana. I'll do it to my kid, Dana. There we go.
Thank there is you. No Dana, only Zool.
And my daughter will come up to me, and I love messing with my kids. My daughter will come up to me and go, "Hey, Dad." And I'll turn around and I'll look at her straight face and say, "There is no Dad, only Zool." And then she, "What are you talking about? There is no talking about, only Zool." just that over and over again repeats every time I think of Ghostbusters. Thank you for "There is no Dana, only yes. Zool."
Oh my goodness.
Favorite line.
I have a nerd addendum to that question that he just answered. Uh-huh. Anybody know who actually spoke that line? Whose voice it was?
Was that Reitman?
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ivan Reitman.
Neat. Ivan Reitman.
Did the voice of Zool.
Very cool. Nice.
I have to admit, though, the only reason I know that is because I looked up a bunch of trivia before we did the episode the other day. I did not know it before that. So, yeah, admission.
Yeah. And actually, Richard, I will say I applaud your choice of the favorite line, because I have lost count of the number of times I have used "What did you do, Ray?" in my role-playing gaming with friends.
Yep.
When, just as you said, when someone performs an action that is perhaps questionable in wisdom, shall we say, and then we start sensing or hearing something terrible coming this way.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You get that player who is like, "I didn't ask how big the room was. I said I cast Fireball."
Yes. Exactly. All righty. So now, Dawood, if you had to pick one, who is your favorite character in the movie?
Ooh.
And then, if they're different, which one is your favorite Ghostbuster from the team?
Okay.
If they're the same, that's fine. But if they're different, then let's hear the two different.
So, wow, it's a toss up. Annie Potts was and probably still is incredibly hot. that was my first redhead crush with Janine. Yes. Oh my god! And then of course I also watched the cartoon, you know, because I was all of like 7, 8 or something like that when it came out. Uh-huh. And I was just like, Janine's just not as hot in the cartoon as she was in the movie.
Well, you know, different target audience. I can see why they might have done that.
but honestly, like her attitude, I mean, she made me all about spunky redheads. But the other toss up is between her and Slimer, because even though Slimer wasn't a big part of the movie, I had his toy as a kid, and I was so into that little floating green blob.
Yay.
Something about it, it was like, it wasn't even an action figure. It was literally just this green translucent thing that I would play with. And it just brought me so much joy.
Cool.
So
fair enough.
But probably Janine was my favorite.
All right.
And in terms of Ghostbusters, mm-hmm. this also shows you where I was. As a kid, I was a weird kid. I mean, not that I'm not weird now, but I was a strange one. You can ask anybody. Egon was my favorite Ghostbuster. Mm-hmm. And there was something about, even now, even though I'm about to go into, you know, games for my bachelor's, my mind is focused on, after that, going into astrophysics, going into the higher sciences, and something about Dr. Egon, what's his last name? Spengler?
Spengler.
The only Ghostbuster whose name I fully remember, because I totally was like, he's the nerdiest of the bunch, and I love him. Like, does he create all their tech? Like, he's just a mastermind. I loved Egon. So hands down.
Excellent.
Excellent. All right. Yeah.
All right. So, Richard, do you have a favorite character? And or, if different, do you have a favorite Ghostbuster?
Originally, I really was a big fan of Dr. Peter Venkman.
Oh, I was hoping you'd say Janine.
She's awesome. That character is great. The way she just tells off Peter, it's like just now, Dr. Venkman.
She got the bug eyes.
I've quit better jobs than this.
Yes.
No, she is amazing. But Peter Venkman used to be my favorite Ghostbusters until I got older and realized what a terrible sleazebag he actually is. I originally thought the whole scene where he's faking that psychic test with Paul Reiser,
right?
It just was funny. And it's just like, oh my God, this guy is terrible. What a complete, yeah. And that's a student. And he just, it's just, now I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm amazed he didn't take advantage of Sigourney Weaver when she was completely possessed now. It's like he kind of turned that around. It's like, okay, maybe he's a lot of bluster. But it's like, oh, but anyway, I really like Harold Ramis' character, Egon Spengler, as far as my favorite character in the book, simply because the dude is just, he's all about the science. But yeah. What made the character for me is when he completely broke at the very end scene. And they asked him, because everybody's standing, there's a giant marshmallow coming at him. And Venkman just turns to him and is like, what do you got, Egon? And he's like, sorry, Peter. Terrified beyond the capacity for rational thought. Yes. And it's like, he's just completely different. But he's able to just accurately state that he is incapable of any kind of rationality at the moment because he's faced with a giant monster about to crush him.
Yeah.
That line, you're right. It's like, that is a great character. So, it's Dr. Egon Spengler. The guy who, the theoretical physicist in this group.
Yes.
Fair enough. So that leads to your favorite Ghostbusters moment. We'll hit it back to Rick if you want to just continue on there.
Tell him about the Twinkie. It's delivered by
Zeddemore.
Zeddemore. Winston Zeddemore. But it's just so deadpan.
Ray, tell about the Twinkie.
Tell him about the Twinkie. Yeah. What about the Twinkie? It's just end the scene there.
Yeah.
All right, Dawood.
So that one's difficult for me. I actually thought about some specific scenes before we started. And as Richard said, the openings, the in the intro, you have Peter with the two doing the whole ESP experiment. Mm-hmm. And that stood out to me also because for a similar reason, I didn't realize how much of a sleazeball Peter was when I was younger. I'm like, I got that he was kind of sleazy and I don't know, maybe I equated it to lazy as a kid, but then I, seeing that scene not too long ago, I was like, wow, this guy right here. And it's like I've actually had friends put in that position in colleges where like their professor was basically trying to hit on us. And I'm just like, wow, really? This flew right over my head as a kid. But it's also, it has that, like the whole movie has this really great comedic vibe to it. So it fits. And like you said, he has a redeeming moment at the end. Cause I remember that one too of Sigourney Weaver being possessed and just like, that was his moment to turn it all around. And he did. So those actual scenes stick out in my mind, but it just reminds me of what good character development this movie has in it. And I'm just like, I think about this in passing every so often, and I have never thought of it that way. Like, oh, wow, there's actually amazing character development through this entire movie. Egon grows a spine, which is awesome. So I love that. But yeah, those two moments stick out.
Excellent. Yeah, that's, I love that response because we literally touch on this in the podcast. Yes. Almost word for word what you just said.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That being said, what kind of date was he planning where he was carrying 300 cc's of Thorazine?
Well, yeah, let's not kink shame here. Right.
Alrighty, with that, moving on from our favorite Ghostbusters moment. So, Dawood, does any of the music in the movie stand out for you?
Oh, are you kidding me? I hear that theme song in my head at least a few times a year where I just start grooving. I'm like, oh, what is that? Oh, it's the Ghostbusters theme. I love that song. I love it.
Nice.
I was actually reading something about the music and the inspiration for some of those songs a little while ago. But yeah, that, I mean, you know, you have some classic 80s theme songs from movies, and that is definitely one of them.
Oh, yeah.
You've had a moment, Rick? Any of the music?
Oh, yeah. The magic, the song Magic.
Yeah.
When the grids turn down and you got all the ghosts flying all over the city, just running rampant. And it's like, but it's got that really cool, thumpy vibe to it. It's just, and the buildup on that song, it's like, please. It's just rolling through. And then the building blows up and Sigourney, we were standing there, you know, all zooled out. And, it's got a really great vibe with the beats are timed to the action that's going on with the taxi cab and everything rolling through. That was just so, I don't know. The music really set the tone for that whole montage scene.
Yeah. If you ever want to go down a rabbit hole, check out Mick Smiley, the guy who composed it. He essentially disappeared not long after this film and never went back to making music. So,
He didn't actually disappear. He just got out of the business.
He got out of the business. Well, okay. You know, according to the article, he disappeared, but then they explained why he disappeared. But yeah, he doesn't, not even interested in talking about it to anybody anymore. It's an interesting rabbit hole too. And I went down that actually right before we did this. So I'm glad you brought that song up because that's also my favorite from the film. Yeah. Let's see. What else we have here? We have Rick, if you could meet anyone from the cast, right? Not just a character from the film, but I mean, if you could actually meet one of the actors, somebody from the cast, who would you choose?
That's a rough one. It's like, I'm a huge fan of Bill Murray, but as far as just the choice of that cast, I really would want to sit down with Sigourney Weaver and have some conversations about aliens. The first two, not the any of the other ones. Whole different topic.
Valid.
And Dawood, how about you?
I think we know what I'm going to say based on some earlier answers.
Yeah.
Harold Ramis.
Picking up a dropping off.
Yep.
I don't even know how old she is yet now, but she was a hilarious actress growing up, and I had seen other movies that Annie Potts was in. I always thought that she was just like, she would be a cool person to hang out with. And I don't know how long she stayed a redhead. I saw a recent picture of her with bleach blonde hair. But there's this kind of like cadre of short, spunky redheads in like TV and movies that I have always wanted to meet. And I got to meet, I don't know if you guys ever saw the show News Radio.
Yeah,
I did not.
But the long redhead in there, and I think in the show her name was Beth. I actually got to meet her at a Comic-Con. She was just hanging out and walking around. And I got to meet her and take a picture with her. And I'm like, Annie Potts, I need her next. Like, I need that collector. So I totally would want to meet Annie Potts.
Well, with luck, maybe one day she'll hear this podcast or maybe not. I don't know. But those dreams could come true.
Yeah, ask her to get on the podcast. I mean, what? All she could say is her, no.
Right?
Yeah.
I'd love to get her voice on video games that I'm doing. I think Annie Potts would make a great voice actress.
Oh, I bet she would. Yeah.
Well, if we get that interview, we might actually ask her if she'd do that. So there you go.
Thank you.
Have her put on that Bronx accent.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Looking forward, Dawood, there is a new film coming up, Ghostbusters Afterlife. What expectations do you have, if any, from this upcoming film?
Well, I will tell you, this is the first I've heard about it, and I'm really excited. My only expectation is Bill Murray.
He's definitely in it.
Good.
It's a continuation somewhat in the future, actually. From what I understand, it's going to be about the offspring of one of the Ghostbusters. So I don't have a whole lot of information on it, and it's supposed to be out either now or fairly soon. So,
really?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's called Ghostbusters Afterlife.
It's flying under the radar, huh?
Well, yeah.
We trailers.
You know, COVID and all that kind of put the kibosh on a lot of things and what normally people would be up on the releases of films. But with COVID, I think a lot of films have just kind of fallen by the wayside. But this one looks exciting. So if you get a chance, watch the trailer for it.
I will do so right after this podcast. No other expectations? Not really. I grew from a person who was into all kinds of sci-fi and into the person now who's like really interested in future sci-fi. So I don't have my ear to the ground on like sci-fi, like modern sci-fi. But I want to check that out. Make my kids finally watch Ghostbusters 1 and 2 with me, and then we can go see Afterlife.
Excellent. And Rick, any expectations?
I have picked that trailer apart forward and backwards.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. I have already listened to all the Voss conspiracy theories on what's going to be in, who's going to be where. It's okay. What do you want to know? I have a lot of hope. This is really going to launch maybe another series of movies. The characters look interesting. It's got that nice little, it looks like it has a lot of heart. The low key buildup. It's got the teenage kind of and I write YA fiction. So it keys right into where I live currently in my novel series. We're just young coming of age stories where it turns out these kids actually have this really powerful legacy that they don't know about. Right. You know, and there's a scene in the trailer, and this is all stuff in the trailer, so I'm not spoiling a dang thing. You guys know that they were going over the plans of the building, which factored greatly into the whole plot of the original Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. That was built by a guy named Ivo Shandor.
Right.
The metals he made out of, he basically turned it into a big gateway. Well, the town, one of the things they show in the trailer is all the stuff that's happening underground and everything, and causing the rumbling and things start surging. Just the mines. They're the Shandor mines.
Nice.
Oh my gosh.
This is probably where the guy got all the selenium and that he built the building from
all
the beginning.
Metals.
And fantastic. If he set up a network underneath that town, it ties right into the original plot. And at one point, you see Paul Rudd cowering in his car and the claw of a terror dog right on the hood.
Nice. Oh,
I love it. I really hope that's true. I mean, no, that part's true, but I really hope that that's the connection.
Yeah. Well, because you can get red herringed on a trailer.
You can. Yeah.
Oh, easy. Yeah. Easy. You know,
but Reitman's
some dream sequence
it,
and it messes you all up.
Right. Reitman's directing it, which is also a good sign. So
his son.
Well, it's still Reitman, right?
Okay. The legacy.
Yeah, just a little save there. Thanks to both of you guys for joining us for this sound table discussion.
Been fun. Yeah, but hey, any other movies When you do the Princess Bride, invite me back.
We will be doing the Princess Bride. Trust me.
It is definitely on the list.
We've got
as
a list.
You wish.
Yeah. We got a list. We will actually be putting a poll up to see also what films people would want to do. Awesome. And at some point, we'll offer to Patreon subscribers and whatnot to be able to co-host with us. So it could be fun.
Very nice.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, it was great. Thanks for being
Absolutely.
With us.
Absolutely.
All right. See you later.
Popped with Daniel and Ben can be found on most of your favorite social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what you heard and would like to support the show, hop on over to Patreon and become a member. There you can get access to extra content, including uncut interviews and Popped gear. For all other questions or content, check out poppedpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.
Many shrubs and zools knew what it was to be roasted in the depths of the slore that day, I can tell you.